Well, thank you for being here, for letting me be here. I appreciate the opportunity to come. I love this church. It's been a while since I've been up here. In fact, I guess I've just been one time since you opened the building. That was the first year. So y'all are settled in and not viewing it so much as the new building anymore. Give you a little update on what's going on with me. Not that it's that important. First of all, I feel very inadequate to speak today. For one thing, I knew it was Founders Day, but I didn't know it was the 100th anniversary. So y'all should have got somebody, some big time preacher.
The big one said you put the thing on your other ear.
Let me tell you something. You're supposed to put this on the other
ear.
Why? No, it works, but it works better the other way. I'll be honest with you. You can turn me down. I never say never. I said I'd never wear one of these stupid-looking things. And I walk in, and guess what Mark hands me? I hate these things. I'm not a pilot on an airplane. It don't feel right. I mean, hearing aids are in my future soon, but not ready for it. Anyway, give you a little update on, I wish y'all had got a big time preacher. I do, for this day. By the way, Mark, how long have you been here? You've been here over a quarter of the history of the church. That's pretty good for somebody just filling in until they got a preacher, isn't it? Yeah, as most of you know, I preached over at Appleton for a long, long time, 17 years. And this past June, I quit preaching there. It wasn't anything, any bad feelings one way or the other. I just felt like I'd run my course there. I don't know that they did. If they did, they were very polite and didn't tell me. But I started working as a full-time chaplain at a nursing home, which has taught me a whole lot of lessons, a whole lot of humility, a whole lot of frustration as well. So I would, I didn't say anything, but I would pray that, I would ask that you remember me in prayer as I try to figure out what I want to do from this point on. I'm thinking about trying to start a church, not anywhere near Alvaton, because that I don't want to in any way be guilty of pulling people away from there. It's a wonderful church. And I want nothing but good for it. But that may be in my future. I want to plant a church in an area that is it's growing by leaps and bounds, and the church, there is a church there, and it's a wonderful church, but in its history, even though it's a pretty large church, they've never had enough young people to even have a youth ministry. Now, I'm talking about a 400 or 500 member church, and they still don't have enough young people. And I'd like to start a church not to compete against them, but to serve an area that's not being served. And that's something I'm thinking about and trying to pray about, and trying to figure, just kind of wandering in the wilderness is what I feel like. And so this is the first Sunday that I've preached since the first Sunday of June. So I feel kind of plumb scared, to be honest. Feel like I'm starting all over again. Turn to the book of Revelation. When do I quit? All right. So I'm going to teach the entire book of Revelation in 30 minutes. I can teach it in less than that, but I'm going to spend 30 minutes on it. Some of you take notes, and I think that's a grand thing. I've not sit and listened to many preachers since I was 22 years old. I was doing the preaching, but it makes me feel good when people take notes. But the few times I have sat there, I find it very helpful to take notes. It just helps you remember things. In 30 minutes, I'm not going to be able to cover all the book of Revelation, but I'm going to give you a whirlwind tour of it. I think we're afraid of this book for the wrong reasons. I think we get mystified and confused by the language used in it. And that's understandable because it's strange language. In fact, by the middle of the second century, 50, 60 years after the book was written, they were already scratching their head over some of the language. I'm not too sure the ones that received it didn't. But anyway, it's crisis language. It developed during the Babylonian captivity. So you see it in Daniel and Ezekiel and Zechariah. But I want to give you a couple of different perspectives to read the book of Revelation. Three. First of all, see the big picture. We're a verse-by-verse people, and that's okay. But the problem is sometimes when we go verse, or at least I am, when we go verse by verse, we get bogged down on one verse and sometimes forget what's going on before and afterwards, but we certainly kind of lose sight of the big picture at times. When I started preaching at my home church, the adult class was in the book of Acts. 5.5 years later, when I went to another church, they were still in the book of Acts. Now, I may be wrong on this, but that's too much time in one book. When we get bogged down studying the book of Revelation, we try to figure out why the evil beasts look like frogs and all the stuff like that. And I don't think we really got to figure that out to appreciate the book. Here's the way I want to. Number one, you ought to read the book of Revelation to get the big picture. And the big picture is the Lamb wins. Okay? The second reason this book was written was to tell people or to remind Christians who they are to worship. The message is worship God and worship the Lamb. This book was written during a time in which pressure was being put upon people. I'm going to add four now. This book was written when pressure was being put on Christian people to worship the Roman emperor. Now, we think that's very strange. Worship an emperor, that doesn't make sense. I mean, this president and the last president, you've had half the country that couldn't stand either one of them. So the thought of us worshiping a leader is kind of bizarre. But, you know, emperor worship is not that far removed from us. In fact, it still exists today. If you don't believe that, watch a documentary on North Korea. They worship the leader. World War II, Japan, as advanced a people as they were, worshiped the emperor and were willing to die for him. So we're not that far removed from emperor worship. Well, the way this thing worked is that some cities, most of them were outside of, well, all the cities were outside the city of Rome. The cities in the Roman Empire, to gain favor from the emperor and from the city of Rome, began to promote the idea of worshiping the emperor as God. Now, they didn't catch on in Rome for a long, long time because the senators didn't take too much to that idea. But in a lot of cities, they began to set up statues to the different Caesars and worship them as God. Now, to worship a Caesar as God, you've got to have a liturgy. You've got to have an order of worship. You've got to have songs. You've got to have poetry. You've got to have prayers. And they developed all of that. And then they decided that you had to follow suit. Everybody needed to participate in this. Well, there's two groups of people that couldn't participate in that, and that would be the Christians and that would be the Jews. And so it became a patriotic thing, a religious thing to persecute those who wouldn't worship the emperor. So you read the book of Revelation with that backdrop. Again and again we hear, worship God. Now the third thing that you ought to notice in reading the book of Revelation, and you really ought to pay attention to this, is it is a book of worship. Look at how many times they break out in song. It's amazing. And it's also worth noting what they worship God for and what they praise Him for. Some of it would make us feel a little bit uncomfortable. But the simple truth of the matter is they praise God for punishing the evil. That's part of it. And fourthly, you ought to read the book of Revelation as a new Exodus. You know the story of the Exodus. I say that, and I'm not trying to insult anybody that doesn't, but I've, as some of you know, I've been teaching at Western for a long time, New Testament and Old Testament, and I am appalled and shocked every semester at how many people don't, how many kids going to college don't have a clue what the Exodus is all about. Now, you grew up in Church of Christ, count yourself blessed because we're a people of the book. You know that story, but a lot of people that go to church all the time don't know the story of the Exodus. Now, the Exodus is God's delivering his people. And that's exactly what is taking place in this book. In fact, you're going to notice there are a number of plagues. Now, the problem is the plagues are described in such wild symbolic language that our minds are kind of blown by that, and we're forgetting that this is probably a natural disaster kind of thing that has taken place where God is trying to get people's attention. God is constantly trying to get people's attention. Y'all know that? He's trying to get people's attention. People just don't want to listen sometimes. You know, I think about, I'm not a movie person. Movies last too long. But there is one movie I've watched over and over again. If you feel the need to chastise me for mentioning a movie that has bad scenes in it, I challenge you to name me one that doesn't. And you say, well, good old Westerns. Well, they shoot people all the time. That's pretty bad in it, right? In fact, they shoot magical guns that shoot 21 times without reloading. So something's wrong with that, too. But anyway, I've asked people this question. In the story of Forrest Gump, Lieutenant Dan is angry with God. And Lieutenant Dan is hanging on the mast of the ship, and he is screaming at God during a storm and saying, is this the best you've got, right? Well, the ship or boat doesn't sink. Who won that contest? You see, there's symbolism in that movie. Lieutenant Dan is sitting on the side of the boat the next day or a few days after that, sitting on the side of the boat, and he says to Forrest, Forrest, I never did thank you for saving me. And he falls off backwards in the water, and then he goes swimming off, and there's this very beautiful scenery behind him of the calm ocean and the sun reflecting on the ocean. Do you realize that symbolism of baptism and him making peace with God? Who won? God is about redeeming, not about destroying. So Lieutenant Dan was cursing God and daring him to do him in. Instead, God redeemed him, and that's what God wanted all along. You know, in the book of Revelation, and I'll go ahead and tell you this, as you get on over into it, what happens is all these plagues are hitting these people. You know what they do at the end of those plagues? They curse God. And they refuse to worship him. Now, why is he hitting them with those plagues? Two things. One, they're evil. Secondly, he's trying to save them. And their response is real foolish. Their response is curse God. You don't curse God and win. You just don't do it. Now, everybody knows the first three chapters, so I'm not even going to look at those. Other than to say, chapter 1, Jesus is alive and well. And he's walking among the churches, chapters 2 and 3. He walks through the seven churches, which are representative of pretty much churches of all time. By the way, I feel like I need to deal with this. Go ahead and put this down, those of you who are taking notes. The book of Revelation, you get into the discussion of amillennial, premillennial, postmillennial, and panmillennialism. And y'all know what panmillennialism is, right? don't worry about it, it's all going to pan out in the end. And that's the best way to approach the book. But you get into all that stuff, and I am a dyed-in-the-wool amillennialist, meaning I don't believe in a literal thousand-year reign on earth. But if I'm proven to be wrong on that, I am not going to be upset with God that I got it wrong. I'm not. I'm not going to worry about it. I'm going to live on earth 1,000 years and enjoy it if that's the way it works out. I don't believe that's what it teaches. But I do believe that the book of Revelation can be seen as a book that has more than one fulfillment. Let me explain. Does the book of Revelation have relevance today for the people in China? For the Christians in China? They've got this massive evil force of communism that wants to destroy our religion. What does the book of Revelation say to them? You stay with God, you win. The beast is going to eventually die. So the book of Revelation has constant application. Now, we are not an oppressed people, so we may not see that as exciting as others do, but we ought to see this book as something that is very, very encouraging. Now, chapter 4, he walks among the churches, then John is invited up to heaven. And he sees one sitting on the throne, which is really not described. We've got some colors describing the one sitting on the throne, but that's about it. You got a rainbow around the throne. He's a promise-keeping God. You've got God in all of His glory, and you've got these strange beings that spend their entire time worshiping God. Now, I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, and I'll be honest with you, it's hit me a few times as an adult because I'm easily bored, which is probably why I'm up here preaching, because I'm a bad audience. But anyway, you've got all these things worshiping. And you think, what are we going to do in heaven? We're going to go to church all the time? That sounds kind of boring. Somebody points out that they don't have preaching in heaven. They just have a lot of singing. That sounds a lot more attractive. I would remind you that they wouldn't be in heaven singing if it wasn't for preaching. But anyway, so there's some validity to that. But have you ever had a moment in your life that is just absolutely indescribably filled with pleasure that you would love to capture again? For some of you, it's right after your child was born, not during the childbirth, but right after the child is born. This may seem too profane, but I don't. To me, it helped me get it. I sadly am a University of Tennessee football fan living in Kentucky. I'm in exile. I don't know what I did wrong, but I'm in exile. It was a historic event. That's what I'm going to tell them. You know, two times every three decades. So, you know, it's a big event. But anyway, besides all that, some of you are, you know, been up to Knoxville, been to the football game, and what, you know, at the start of the year, before you know how you're going to do, the first game of the year, when they form that tee and you're in the middle of 102,000 people screaming like crazy, celebrating life, celebrating. Some people are celebrating liquor, but that's we're not talking about them because they don't remember the game. What dumb people they are! But anyway, it's just got to be one of the most indescribable senses of excitement that I've ever experienced. Folks, heaven's going to be like that all the time. Whatever moment you can conjure up that you've had that was just overwhelming, that you can't describe it, filled with pleasure, that's what heaven's going to be like. What's the guy in search of meaning? What's that guy's name? Yeah, Frankel. He pronounced it the way scholars do. I call him Frank. But anyway, Viktor Frankl And the search for meaning, trying to find, make meaning in life, or understand, find meaning in life when life is just horrible. Describes one day when he's out there starving to death and freezing to death in the concentration camp with no hope of anything better. And in one of those days and one of those moments, he reflected back upon his wife on their wedding night. And he said, here he was in the midst of all of this squalor, all of this death, all of this dying, all of this cruelty. And in that moment, he was transported in his mind to this scene of bliss. Now, his body was here, but his spirit was in this moment of bliss. And he said for the first time that he understood the saying that the angels are lost in their adoration of God. And that's incredible, isn't it? Just to be so caught up, so enamored, so overcome with the presence of God that all you feel is a sense of excitement and enjoy, and it never ends. That's heaven. And these elders and these four beasts are flying around and kneeling and casting their crowns, and they're worshiping God. And that's what we ought to do, because He is the God that created all things. Chapter 4, verse 11. It's amazing. Go back and read the book of Psalms. It's amazing how many times the psalmist praises God for His creation. We ought to. Everything that exists exists because God created all things. And He is to be worshipped and adored for that. But anyway, he notices that the one sitting on the throne has a scroll in his hand. And an angel says, who is worthy, or a call goes out, who is worthy to open the scroll? And they do a little search in heaven. Now, that is, they don't have to do that. This is drama. No, they know the answer to this, but they do this for John's sake. And they do a search, and they can't find anybody that's worthy to take the scroll from his hand. And John starts to weep, and the angel says, don't weep. Behold the Lion of the tribe of Judah. And so he turns, and there is the Lamb that had been slain. There's Jesus. And Jesus steps forward and takes the scroll. And then he starts to pull the seals off the scroll. And you know this, chapter 5, you've got the first seal is broken and a white horse comes out. And he's out going out to make warfare. And the red horse appears next, and he's out to bloodshed, to bring about bloodshed. The third seal is broken. It's a black horse. It's bringing famine, pestilence. These are natural occurrences. You got warfare. You got bloodshed. You've got famine. You've got disease. You've got all of that that goes with warfare. Now, interestingly enough, and I just wanted you to see this, and this shows you that a lot of this is based on history. When that third horse comes out, the price of wheat is given, and the price of barley is given, and that's barley especially is poor man's food, but the price is inflated, and that's what happens when everything is destroyed, right? It's inflated. But now watch what it says. This is in chapter 6 and verse 6. At the end of it, it says, and do not harm the oil and the wine. Now, isn't that strange? Wheat and barley, the prices are inflated, but don't harm the oil and the wine. That's rich people stuff. Rich people are usually the last to suffer in hard times. And to be honest, if you've read the book of Amos lately, rich people sometimes really don't care how hard it is on the poor people. And there's actual documentation of a time in which Domitian, the Roman emperor, has to stop people from turning wheat fields into wine and grape, vineyards. Because the rich people are buying up the land, kind of like what's going on today. Everywhere you look, there's a vineyard popping up. That's a sign of luxury. And so he actually has to say, put a royal edict out, stop turning the wheat fields and the barley fields into vineyards. We've got plenty. And this oil, that's, you know, you have to have it, but you can get by without it. The rich people, we're not concerned with the poor people. And so they're the last to be affected by this, and sometimes that's because they're hard-hearted too. But anyway, the next horse, of course, comes out as death, which obviously follows warfare, bloodshed, famine, pestilence, and all that. Well, then the fifth seal is broken. And this is my favorite part of it, because if you've lost loved ones, this is comforting, as well as chapter 7 and chapter 14 and chapter 21 and 22. It's a comforting book. It really is. But there were Christians that had lost their loved ones because they were Christians, and the Romans had put them to death, and they're worried about them. Where are they? When this fifth seal is opened, John sees souls that had been slain under the altar. They're with God. And they're crying out, when are you going to avenge our blood on the earth? There again, we've toned down the sense of God's justice so much that we don't feel comfortable with this kind of language. But they want God to avenge their death, and they're told, okay, here's some white robes. Go rest a while. It's going to happen. But it's not going to happen until other people follow your path. In other words, more Christians are going to die. That's not such good news. But it's part of what life is about. And being a Christian, you may have to die for your faith. Doesn't that sound strange and meaningless in our society? Well, in chapter 6 and verse 12, you've got a sixth seal open, the sun becomes black, and you've got all these people that are, all this cosmic stuff going on, and you've got these powerful people. All of a sudden, for the first time, it seems something gets their attention, and they began to try to hide out in caves and calling for the rocks to fall on them and hide them from the faith of God. From the face of God and the wrath of the Lamb. Now, I want you to look across the page for me, wherever it is on you, maybe the next page. But in chapter 7, you've got a host of people that are standing and praising God, or kneeling and praising God, but they're praising God. So you've got one group of people that are opposing God, and when God shows up, they're scared, and they want to hide. And you've got other people that are celebrating the fact that they're in the presence of God. Now see, that's your choices in life, isn't it? You can either be a person that one day is going to celebrate being in the presence of God, or you're going to be the kind of person when God shows up, so to speak, you're going to be wanting to hide somewhere. That's as simple as I know how to make it. And the only way that you can be one of those people celebrating being in the presence of God is to know the Lamb. You worship the wrong thing, when the real God shows up, you're going to beg for a big old rock to hide you. And it won't do any good. So in chapter 7, you've got the 144,000, our Jehovah's Witness friends who we admire their zealousy for spreading their peculiar doctrine. It's not 144,000, because if it was, it would be just Jews. And wouldn't you hate to be 12,001 righteous person from Judah, because you get left out, because there's only 12,000. Now, y'all know the math on this. 12 represents organized religion, 12 tribes of Israel, 12 apostles, 12 times 12 is 144. It's just symbolic of saying all of God's children. That's all it means. This is, after all, the book of symbols. Buddy, that'll get your attention. I don't even need a hearing aid to get that one. I don't know what that says, Mark, that they put in such an obnoxious buzzer for you. But anyway. So these people are standing around the throne, and they're worshiping, and it's a great and a glorious scene. And one of the elders says to John, "Who are these people, and where have they come from?" And I like John's answer, "Sir, you know." In other words, "I don't, please tell me." But a very clever way of saying that. And so he tells them who they are. He tells John who they are. "These are the people who have come out of the great tribulation. They've washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. I'm glad I'm not going through a great tribulation, but I want to be washed in the blood of the Lamb, because then I can be with these people." So they break out in worship and song again, or you've got this poem, whatever it is. I like a version that has it in stanza form that tells you that there's something going on. They're quoting something. It's a song. It's a poem. It's something going on besides just a narrative, and I think that's important. Chapter 8. You see the people in heaven. Chapter 8. You've got the Lamb opened the seventh seal, and there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. It seems like I told you this, but some of you may have forgotten, so I get to tell it again. Kind of like my cat joke that I first told when I first came up here 100 years ago. Still a good joke. You've had action, 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 right? I'll tell you the cat joke later. You don't remember it? Were you not married then? Maybe you were courting then, and you were so blissfully unaware. You did not know what you were getting into. But anyway, when I was a seventh grader, we had this gorgeous new teacher, she was over study hall, and She said, "All right, everybody in here, sit down, take a seat, be quiet, get to study." I was seventh grade. I didn't have any good sense. Mark can tell you about the development of your brain. You're basically should be considered insane from the age of sixth grade up until 25. Men should not be held accountable till they're 40, and I'm hoping to move that back. But anyway. So I decided to mock this gorgeous young lady. "Everybody sit down, start studying, be quiet." And you could see her tense up. She had her back. She's putting up the book. And she just stopped. And this gorgeous young teacher turned around. And I was scared to death. She said, "Who did that?" Thankfully, nobody told on me. But in the minute that she stared us down, I was scared to death. Kind of like the time when I was sitting on the back seat at church during a revival where you can have a preacher who can say things that the local preacher can't say and get away with. And we were watching a guy snoring, and we was giggling, and then his mother elbowed him, and he passed gas. And we were laughing a lot. And the preacher stopped, and he pointed to us. And he said, "When the boys on the back row can be quiet, I will continue." And he stopped. That was the first time I felt the wrath of God. Because not only did I know that everybody in my little church knew it, I was in on it. My parents knew I was in on it. And I don't know how long he remained silent. but it scared me to death. Well, we've had action, 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 and now silence. Folks, just because God is silent doesn't mean he's not listening. In fact, it may mean he is about to act. And chapter 8 on is God is acting on behalf of his people. Thank y'all so much. First time since the first Sunday in June, and I'm still scared to death.